Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current and brought to you by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance and DataFax. This show shares personal stories and insight from those who are giving back and making a difference so we can learn and do the same. We cover life lessons, business advice, passion, and purpose. Now here's our host, the CEO of City Current, Jeremy Park.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current. I'm your host, Jeremy Park. We're here with our good friend, Andrew Gieselman. He's the CEO of Sandler Training, and we get to talk all about leadership, executive coaching, making a difference. Let's just dive right in. Andrew, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
So the fun of this show is we get to know you personally. Here in the Mid-South, we know all the great videos you put together and everything you do with City Current. But let's dive in and get to know you better personally.
Sure.
So start out with a little bit of just, you know, you growing up and what your childhood was like.
Yeah, so grew up in Memphis, and I've got four brothers and sisters. I've got an older brother and sister and a younger brother and sister. And so we all grew up here, and we had a great, had a good childhood. Mom and dad was from Memphis originally, and mom was from Clarksdale. So, but our roots are all here. We're all kind of spread out now. My brothers do live here in Memphis. One of my sisters lives in California, and the other sister lives in Little Rock.
Give me maybe one either family tradition or something that was always fun growing up.
Oh, man, probably my favorite thing about growing up was probably Christmas time. Grandparents would come up from Clarksdale, and they'd bring a big truckload full of presents. And, of course, we love to unload all that stuff.
Absolutely.
That was awesome. So, yeah, that was fun seeing them. They'd come up on Christmas Eve. We'd have a big deal. You know, Dad would always he'd cook these big, giant tenderloins and, like, the big long strips, you know, and so they'd last for, like, 3 or 4 weeks. But it was a lot of fun. That Christmas time was good. And we were always together, and it's just something that sticks. It always will.
Here in your office, you have an office for your dad, and you have all these baseball caps.
Yeah.
So talk about kind of that.
So when we built this office out, I guess that was probably about 7 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. So about 7 years ago, I decided to make one of the offices a place for Dad to hang out, because he had retired and he was done, right? So I thought it'd be cool to have him up here and come hang out with us and be a part of what we're trying to grow and do. So Dad, over the years, he was a head muni trader for his career, basically. And when he would wear a baseball cap every day on the floor and at First Tennessee. And so over the years, I mean, he literally has collected, like, just those 50-gallon black bags, you know. He's just got hats and hats and hats. One of the coolest things is that Dad has hats. People knew that he was a hat guy, so they just started sending him hats. And he'd get 3 or 4 hats a week, right?
But he was like one of the first influencers then.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, man, he was really, he just, the hats is his thing. Still is today. But he has hats of teams. Like, he has the hats of the losing teams of, like, a World Series, but he has the hat as if they won it, because, you know, they made them. So he had, like, some insiders that would send him, right? So he's got some really cool stuff. Anyway, when we put his office together, we put a bunch of hats on the wall and the baseball stadiums that he has and baseball bats, and just that's his thing. He's a huge Cubs fan. He's a huge Cardinals fan. Yeah, it's kind of a weird split there. So he has a place to come hang out. And that was important for me because I wanted him to be a part of it. I wanted him to be around when he wanted to and just give him a place to go think and hang out and you know, be a part of it. So it was
yeah,
cool.
I think it's very cool.
It was really cool.
Give me one lesson or favorite bit of advice from your parents?
Oh, man. That's a great question. You know, I think probably patience is maybe one of the things that I've taken away from them. And the reason I say that is because of the five of us, I was the middle of five. Plus, I'm left-handed, so I'm uniquely special, right? Had a hard time finding my place, a lot of learning disabilities, a lot of blocks there. struggled with my mom and dad, struggled with learning, really, really, really struggled growing up. And my brothers and sisters, for the most part, they did really well in school, and you know, they had their issues or whatever, but I was like a lab rat. We had to get me tested and figure out, like, you know, he needs resource and he needs help and he's special. And so, but I think going through that and struggling with my mom and dad, and then looking at our relationship today, like, I couldn't see it at the time, but going through all the fights and the crying and the anger and the, and just why did I have to be different? I think they even questioned, like, why can't you be like the others? That was hard to go through, but I think they were very patient with me. And then in turn, I think I was very patient for the relationship to develop. And so years later, now, my dad is my buddy, and my mom everybody loves their mom, right? But I have a lot of respect for my mom because she put up with me for a long time. So I think that patience spreads.
How does that patience then carry over to you now as a father and husband?
You know, that's a great question too. Patience, I think, so our makeup is unique. I'm married to Catherine. Catherine has a son, and he's 18, lives in North Carolina, South Carolina. And my daughter, Callie, she's 20. And then I've got the twins, Liam and Horner, and they're 8 years old. And I think more so, you know, with Callie growing into her adulthood and figuring out what she wants to do and what she wants to be, she's a beautiful girl figuring out a lot of things, you know, on her own, and she's doing a good job with that. But it takes patience to let, you know, that come around, to let her work through that. And with the boys, with the twins, there's a plethora of patience needed for them. I mean, well, first of all, you know, they're 8 years old, so they're on kind of the cusp of starting to figure out that they know a little bit more than what they thought they did. And so, you know, you start getting into the conversations about, you know, this, that, and the other life and things like that. And it's really fun. It's a fun age. But the real patience, like we experienced with Stephen, Catherine's son, and with my daughter Callie, the real patience is going to be as they get into those early teenage years and watching them mold and all. That's where it's needed. You know, that to me is where it's needed. So we set some guidance and some direction for them at this age, and then when they move into those older years, you know, we're only, you know, four years away from that.
Yeah, about six.
Yeah, it's pretty quick. Yeah. So I think that's where the patience will be. And I remember, you know, my mom and dad, they're big on, you know, what goes around comes around. And I've seen a lot of that. I've seen a lot of that. So the way I treated my parents, I can say I've been a victim of the same. And I'm sure it's going to get worse. I'm sure it's going to get worse. I was just one of those kids. I just took a long time to figure it out. But I was always really, really good at sales, and they always supported it. Like when I was a kid, I did like the magazine drives, and I would win those. Like I would be the top guy, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go out and figure that out. And so we support, like, my parents were really good at supporting the things that I was really good at, you know, and baseball was one, and this magazine things was one, selling was one. And then we see that in the boys, and Liam and Horner, especially at their age, watching and kind of developing and supporting what they really love and what they're good at. And even if they're not that great at it, they still want to be a part of it. You know, it for them, it's all fun. And that's what it needs to be.
The passion
that's what
side it needs of it, absolutely.
Be. Yeah.
Well, and I think, too, that you hear it a lot with athletes, but also, too, the most successful business leaders is they weren't necessarily the straight-A students. They were the ones that had to overcome, and whether it was dyslexia or other, you know, issues in their lives, they overcame and had to persevere and have the patience and everything you're talking about. And that created strength and resilience and their ability to really have the confidence to be themselves, which then created more opportunities in their lives and in their professional careers as well. And so I think everything you're talking about, it really does kind of pave this unique opportunity that you've been able to create with Sandler Training and everything you're doing to this day. We'll come back because I think, you know, I want to tie in the stories of overcoming on your end with your family and especially your two boys. We'll come back to that in a second. But let's go ahead and dive into Sandler Training. Describe for listeners what you do and career-wise, like what your day-to-day career is.
Yeah, so Sandler Training is a franchise, and we've got probably maybe 200 to 250 locations worldwide. And so there's a lot of people like me that run a franchise and what they're trying to do. And ours, I think, you know, we do sales training and development. That's a big piece of Sandler. That's really what Sandler was originally created as, was sales training and development. And then we got into a lot of the coaching aspect of that. Like, if someone's going to learn how to change, if they're going to learn how to drive themselves differently, if they're going to learn techniques, what we realized over time was it's really difficult to do that, to implement change, to live through and drive through change without some guidance from the coaching perspective. Like, what does it really mean to an individual? And then it grew into management development, and then it grew into leadership development, and then it grew into customer service development and training and things like that. So we've got different programs for different people. But the coaching aspect of our business, especially the executive coaching, is, you know, it's a real eye-opener, because people have to be willing to look in the mirror, and they have to be willing to kind of lay down with you, hey, here's what I'm trying to figure out. And what's interesting about it is most people, whether they're coming to us for sales development, leadership development, they want to learn how to run their companies better, or they want to learn about putting processes in place, whatever it is, it really has to start with their willingness to just to realize, we call it intellectual humility, right? Like, they have done a great job of getting to where they are.
Yeah.
But what got them here is probably not going to get them there. And so if they're willing to be open-minded about where they need help and letting people help them, because they're not going to have to figure it out for the rest of their life, they want to know how to fast-track some things, that's really where we see a good fit for people coming to us.
I think so much of that too, though, especially for men, is putting aside the ego, because the ego becomes, you know, obviously it gives you some confidence in some areas, but it can be such a detriment to your point, to being able to see the forest for the trees and see other opportunities, but just to get out of the way and make the best decisions, because you start getting that ego involved, and it leads you down a destructive path. So I think that's, to me, one big piece of this, like you mentioned, humility, but it's setting aside the ego so you can actually grow.
That's right. So what we see is there's kind of two sides to ego, right? I think there's a very healthy ego, which is more of a confidence play. Mm-hmm. Then there's a very unhealthy ego, which is more of an arrogance play. Right? And you probably see that, you know, from time to time. We see it from business owners all the time. I think that, you know, what drives ego when someone really has to profess their, I'm going to call it arrogance because that's really kind of what it is. They may not see it or agree with it, but when they have to profess their talent, their strength, their goodness, we know there are a lot of things behind the scenes that are driving that, right? And there, you know, there would be some problems or some issues or some concerns, and they're not comfortable with themselves. And so they kind of push this ego out because they want to staple themselves as being great. Well, people see them as great, right? So there's a difference. People that have a really healthy, natural ego, they're usually very humble. They have a lot of humility. They can laugh. Like, that's the one thing, is that they can make the mistakes, they can screw stuff up, and they can laugh about it, and they can figure out how to do it different next time.
Yeah.
People that are afraid to fail and that are afraid to be seen as doing something that wasn't in their best interest, or making decisions that backfired on them, if they try to avoid all that because they're worried about that concept of failing, and that would disrupt their, you know, their the way they're seen as a human being, they don't grow as fast as they could, because they're trapped. You know, they're trapped. They have some insecurities, right?
Yeah.
So we try to help break those down, help them look, you know, at themselves differently and learn how to do things a little bit differently. And for the people that we've had success with over the years, it's a powerful process.
Speaking of process, I know you're big on process and creating process and accountability. But like anything, there has to be, for success to be realized, you have to have intentionality. Mm-hmm. And then you have to understand kind of the strategy and the plan, but there has to be a process. So walk us through when it comes to process. And I know it's different, obviously, sales to leadership to companies, but your philosophy on creating a process to ultimately create success.
Yeah, so it comes down to systems and processes, obviously, right? And so a lot of people, if you're talking about sales, very few, we just recognize that very few companies, like they can have a great sales team, they can be doing really well, but they're not all doing the exact same thing. Like they're not all really going to market the same way, or they're trying to figure out things differently. So when we think about learning, whether it's in sales or leadership or whatever it is, there's really three pieces that are moving. There's the attitude or the belief system of the individual. There's the behavior or the action that they take. And there's the technique that they learn. And if we're not managing and coaching through all of those things, so we may teach a process, which is a technique, right? And we can teach that process. But if they don't take action to implement it, they won't see a different result. When they do take action to implement it and they see something change, that creates the ambition and drive that's missing to fuel the fire to try to figure out how to continue to do more action, make the technique better, and really start to put this process in place for that ultimate feeling of success. Watching people grow out of where they think that they, a lot of people, they believe that they're worthy of what they have today. And what blocks most people from really becoming strong is that they don't feel worthy for what they could be tomorrow, right? Mm. There's a self-worth problem.
Yeah.
When you take that concept into a leadership model, I think a lot of people, a lot of CEOs, they get involved with groups where they can get together and they can talk and they can chat and they can have a speaker come in and spend a day together and just work through some things. And I think that's good. What Sandler really created in the leadership, the excellence for leadership was, we created a platform where there are very specific processes. There are very specific systematic processes that some are in place for companies and some are not. And it drives everything as most programs do. It drives everything from the personal vision of the person that runs the company into what they want their company vision to be. But then we branch that out into a lot of different avenues that deal with how well are your positions aligned, how well are your groups aligned. If you're running silos in your company, do they all actually create alignment with the ultimate vision that exists and the mission statement to drive that vision?
Yeah.
And that goes into really getting into the individual jobs that you have in your company. How many of those positions are actually developed, so the person working, whether it's a laborer or, you know, or in accounting or in sales or whatever it is, are those positions really developed so that the individual knows how what they're trying to accomplish is driving that vision, mm-hmm. right? And that there's usually a disconnect there. And if you take it one step further, the more you know about individuals in your company and what they're trying to accomplish personally, you will get so much more out of them to drive that vision, because if you can help them meet their goals, they will always help you meet yours.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just a big disconnect that we see.
And I know that carries over into your coaching philosophy, especially is it's like, I know you've said before, you don't like the cookie cutter where it's like, we're just going to walk yeah. you through. Like, I want to get to know, because everyone coming in is different and their motives are a little different. And so, you know, on your end, talk about some of the questions you like to ask when somebody's first sitting down with you. How do you start to kind of unpack where they are, where they need to go, but looking at it from that personal, customized approach versus a cookie cutter approach?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the reason that I don't necessarily fall into the belief that a cookie cutter approach is effective, I'm not saying it's not effective, it helps, but I don't know that it's you know, if you come to me to get coached and I say, here's what we're going to work on today, then it's my agenda. It's not your agenda, right? And if I'm driving the agenda, then I don't know what's really going on in your mind. So I don't even know if you're ready, prepared mentally, physically for what we're going to go through if I'm driving that agenda. On the other hand, when people come in, and it's always interesting the first session that we have, because I think people are, I believe the human's biggest fear is that they're going to be judged. I really believe that's a big one. So
yeah.
They don't want to unpack. Yeah, they don't know what that's like. So when we get into kind of our first meetings, we just dig in ultimately into where they are and what they're trying to accomplish. What's the big picture look like? And then from there, I'm listening for what is it that are just key indicators that I can take and ask about to dig deeper. You know, I think when you look in the concept of coaching, okay, when you look at it, any manager in a company, they're responsible for supervising, they're responsible for training, they're responsible for coaching their people, and they're responsible for mentoring. And very few of them actually know the coaching concept. They realize every one of us as humans, we have the answers internally. We have the drive, we have the knowledge, we have the answers, but it's how we bring that to the surface for them. And that takes a lot of questioning and not a lot of telling. Most of the time when managers and owners are spending a lot of their time telling their people what to do and how to do it, that's what we call training. The coaching is sitting back and really questioning individuals to understand why they say the things they say, why these things are concerns, what if they weren't concerns, what would be different if. And so there's a lot of questions that happen. So when someone comes in to one of our sessions or one of my sessions, it's really about them. It can't be about me. It can't be about my agenda. They're here to gain clarity. They're here to unpack and lay out on this table whatever it is that's going on in their head. And sometimes it's funny because a lot of people say, man, you need a couch in here for me to lay out on because right. This is like, is this like business psychology? Yeah. And I'm like, well, let's not make any mistakes. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist. But yeah, it is because I believe that people have to figure out how their personal life and their professional life mix. I think people struggle naturally to try and separate the two. Mm-hmm. My belief is, and what our experience has shown us is, if they can learn how the two can coincide in a way that's advantageous for their growth and for their love for their families or what their life is going to be, man, they make so much progress, Jeremy. It's fascinating when they stop, they just realize that the problems and issues and concerns that they have, they're not alone. It's not like they're the only ones fighting all those demons, right? Yeah. But when they can start to do that in a way that mends together within their professional life, with their personal life, it just creates a whole new vision for them of what they're capable of what their potential is.
How has all of this changed you, especially as a CEO?
So people would say, my family laughs at me about this, obviously, today. I don't think we laughed about it coming up. But from the time I was 18 until the time I was probably maybe 26 or 27, I easily stacked up about 24 different jobs. And part of that was my fault, obviously, you know, and part of it was my thinking that, you know, I go from job to job because this guy doesn't know what he's doing or that company doesn't. I had that attitude at a young age, right? I was cocky and, oh, you don't know what you're doing. But when it was a sales position or something like that, it was successful. But I didn't have in my career, I didn't have my first job for a solid 12 months until I was 27 years old. And from there, I worked, and then a few years for a corporation, and then I left that and started a company with another guy, and then that led into becoming a client of Sandler, and that led into becoming an associate of Sandler, and then that led into me, buying out and owning the franchise.
Yeah.
So the question that you asked was how does it affect me? So I believe that people are really good at coaching, training, and developing the things that they need to be doing the most themselves. I really believe that. I believe that what makes a good coach a good, like if you think about it, you have an incredible player like Michael Jordan or an incredible golfer like Tiger Woods, and they have a coach, but you don't see their coach out on the tours, right? And I think there's some legitimacy to that. I think that coaches are coaches because they know what to do. They know how to help people get there. They're good about it at some place. So when I think about how it's helped me, Sandler to me, even as a client before I got into it, it challenged me to get outside my comfort zone. And that was not easy. It was a constant battle to get outside of my comfort zone and really figure out what I was made of. And if I hadn't gone through that, if I hadn't experienced that, if I hadn't lived that, I really don't have any business trying to help other people figure out how to do it for themselves. So I think it's made me better as a CEO. owning the business, because I think it positions me to show our clients and even our employees that it's about doing the work, right? We don't have trainers that train. We all do it. So I'm selling still, right? I'm coaching, I'm training, I'm developing. And so when people see what we're doing in the room, they know we're doing it on the street,
right?
So there's not a separation there. And I, even though I, you know, run the business, I'm still very much in the business, you know, so there's got, you got to figure that out as well. But what's made it me stronger through the years is training the mechanism for selling and for leading, because in order for me to be good at training it, I have to be good at living it.
Yeah.
Really. And that's, it's not like take the material and launch it. It's like, I want to put myself through it and all those pains and all the growth and all the things that we're doing, so that when it comes time to teach those lessons or to coach those people, we've experienced what's that like in our own life.
Yeah, it's authentic. Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Give me, because you do a lot of speaking and you do videos and all sorts of stuff, which are super creative and amazing. And you put those out all over, obviously, on social media, so anybody can find those. Give me maybe one or two of your favorite, and I'll leave it to you whether you go more the sales or the executive or the coaching side, but just one or two of your favorite tips. When you're out there doing the public speaking, what are one or two tips that you like to throw out there?
So I think, okay, when it comes to speaking, authenticity is huge. It really is. Anybody can talk about any topic, and it's interesting. I think if I have one uniqueness, I think in the talks that I do, is that I don't prepare talks to be like a presentation or a canned presentation. I really do. A lot of the talks come out of what is going on with the audience, right? And that's hard to do, especially in a big audience. But everybody can relate to this concept of authenticity, and everybody can relate to the power of vulnerability. And if there's anything I talk about, it's that concept of what does vulnerability do in creating you to be stronger and better around not just your family, but around your peers and around the people that you're with. It's so unique for human beings, as scared as we are, which is normal, as fearful as we are of being discovered or uncovered. A lot of people are not even sure how they got to where they are, and so they don't want anybody to know that, right? So they stay in their closet, and they're over here kind of like hiding. They don't want anybody to turn the light on. Don't find out what I don't know, right? But when somebody can move past that and actually accept the vulnerability that exists, and they can be an authentic human being, right? Everything beyond that the potential is so limitless. And it's not necessarily about the material or the systems or the processes. It's really about just being able to live inside of your own body in a way that you're free. And you're free from the pressures of how society judges you. And you're free from, because you're willing and you're able to have imperfections. And it's just such a huge topic.
So all of this is kind of related to you as a change maker on the business side. Let's switch over on the personal side. And as I mentioned, we'd come back to this, but you know, a big part of you've got a lot of philanthropic outreach. You're involved in a lot of different ways, including even, you know, using Sandler Training to help nonprofits. And you
have
a whole scholarship on that side, and we'll talk about that in a second. But let's go back to on your end, where I kind of see, this has always been embedded in you and your family, but especially with the birth of your sons. You saw early on the power of the NICU unit and getting involved with, in this case, obviously a hospital group to start really using your power for good. So talk about philanthropy, what it means, and then let's dive in with the story of your two boys.
Yeah. So to me, the concept, when I think about philanthropy or just finding things to invest time, money, energy into, you know, if we all have, I love what you say about this, but we all have the ability to change. Like we all can make a change. It's just taking action to make a change, right? And whether that's financial or whether that's, you know, time or knowledge or whatever it is, you know, we work with one nonprofit, you know, STS Enterprise, and they, I'm coaching Jeremy and Alton there, and we're working with them pretty closely, and they use our facility all the time. We just kind of open it up for them. And so we're helping them to kind of figure out how to grow and how to get the income that they need to really sustain this thing. And there's, it's what they're doing. Like me personally, I've just got such a belief in what they're trying to do with the youth in our city, mm-hmm. and they need it. So, and I'm not going to go out and do that work, but I can certainly support it. I can help them, teach them how to go out and fundraise, and I can teach them how to coach their people, and I can teach them how to be a mentor for their students, right? And so there is there's an element when I think about philanthropy of are you bought in? You know, I will say this: there was an interesting when you know we did the scholarship, so we had a lot of interest. A lot of companies applying for that scholarship that we decided to do this year. And one of the companies that came in, their number one concern, we asked everybody, what's the number one thing you want to fix over everything else? And the most interesting answer we got to that was, we want to know how to motivate our board. And man, Jeremy, when I saw that, I thought, well, A, you probably need a new board. But in reality, man, if people, when it comes to supporting these nonprofits and it comes to helping them, again, whether it's financial or whatever it is, your energy, your time, your effort, your learning, the belief has to be there from the top down. If people serve on boards because it looks good on their resume, which I know a lot of people do that, and it's okay, but there has to be a passion, a willingness, a desire to take action and help that nonprofit get to where they're not. And so to me, how do we serve these nonprofits that are creating change in our community? You know, the Thistle and Bee and Eli there, Eli Cloud has been awesome since she started. They won the scholarship. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she's tough and she is plugged in big time to our work. And she's thinking about it constantly, and she's driving it back to her board, and they're going to have – it's going to be an interesting year to watch them grow. It's going to be really cool. But I love supporting them. We really believe in their cause and what they're doing for the women that they work with and what they stand for.
Yeah, and those women are getting out of trafficking and prostitution, and they're giving them a support and housing and job skills and even opportunities for jobs to create all sorts of products, whether it's honey and granola. So that's for listeners, a little context.
Right. Yeah. So, and it's amazing because it's a 2-year program. Mm-hmm. There's no like one and done, which that matches our model. Cause when people get involved with us, they're going to be here for like 2 years. That's the deal. So, that's the learning process, but they're teaching the same. They're teaching a learning process of how these women can come out of that trafficking environment and start to live, start yeah. to change. So I think it has a lot to do with how much do you believe in what you want to support, you know? And I mean, we have Milla's House, and Milla's House is kind of a branch off of Baptist's
The Kimmins Wilson.
Yeah, the Kimmins Wilson Center for Good Grief. For Good Grief, and my brother, obviously, our family is heavily involved with that. But even without that, what they bring to the community is a place for adults and children to go and deal with grief, the loss of a loved one. And what's so powerful about that people I think don't think about is that if we didn't have a place for people to go in this city, and it's free for them to go there, if we didn't have a place to go like that, then what happens is when these things happen in our city, people that don't go and get help, they don't process, they don't work, they don't grieve, they don't know how to, they act out. And when they act out or they self-medicate or whatever, it doesn't help our community. So, I think if you believe in it and you believe in the people doing it, then support it. But if you're going to support something, do it all the way.
Yeah, with conviction.
Oh, absolutely. Man, total conviction.
Yeah.
Total
and
conviction.
I agree with you. I mean, if you're on a board, you've got to be committed. And you've got to play your role. And it can't just be a resume blur because, to your point, the fact that the board is not engaged is such a severe loss, not only for the nonprofit, but for our community as a whole. Going back to Milla's House and a lot of the stuff you've done, so much of it, we don't necessarily need to dive in here, but you know, your brother and sister-in-law won a Spark Award for their efforts with Milla's House. It's a very personal thing for you and your family because, unfortunately, Batten's disease you know, took the lives of loved ones mm-hmm. within your family. And so share from that vantage point of just, you know, what that then creates on the personal drive side of this is a personal mission in terms of the commitment and to see the legacy of your family, but ultimately to continue to fight for that sort of change.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And it really boils down to, yes, my brother Fraser had two daughters that were diagnosed with Batten disease and they've since passed. And that disease took them away from him. And I don't think it's nearly as much about what, you know, as a family, we were always trying to find a new normal, right? And that's outside of what my brother and his family, his wife and their daughter Ann Carlisle were going through, because none of us can relate to that, right? It's unfathomable. And a lot of these nonprofits are like that. I mean, they're just the work they're doing, like we can't relate to the work that we're doing, right? So it's not just that it's a family thing that drives me for that, but there is a huge, huge internal drive for me to do something that allows me to support my brother. And I've, you know, if I'm going to be really vulnerable about it, I think when we were going through that and the girls had their disease, I didn't know, I really struggled with how to be there. Like I didn't know, what does that look like? What are we supposed to do? And of course, come together as family and support family, but what does that mean? And how do we do that? And I look back and I think I missed some opportunities to support them in certain ways. So now, I really want to help that mission, because I know he's passionate about it. And if I can get on board with him and he and I together and the other family members, and we can jump in and really start to grow this thing, I think it has massive potential. But that's where that drive comes from, is loving my brother. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, and loving my family. Nothing easy about it, but so many people in the city go through this. They lose, like the children that lose their parents or parents that lose their children. And if you haven't experienced that, I haven't, you know, you mentioned the NICU, and yeah, when the boys were born, they spent, you know, about the first 3 months of their life, you know, in a box, you know, basically until they could come out of it. And a lot of people have experienced that. Some good and some end up being okay, but you know, that was tough. So we took them home and they're healthy. And so, yeah, to try and relate to it is not the right thing to do. I think people always are shocked. Like, how do you live through that? I don't know the answer to that. And I think people have to figure out the answer to that. But that's why you have a place like Mila's House, or that, because that's what you need to figure out how to make it, you know, through anything mm-hmm. when it comes to that. So.
Thank you for listening to our Changemakers podcast. City Current is a catalyst of over 100 partners joining forces and funds to power the good through free events, positive media, and philanthropy. If you like our efforts and you're looking to power the good with us, follow us on social media at City Current and check out our website at citycurrent.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. And if you know a changemaker, please reach out and let us know so we can consider them for a future show. The Changemakers podcast is brought to you by DataFacts. DataFacts is a national provider of trusted background screening products such as criminal searches, drug screening, employment and education verifications, and post-hire monitoring to employers of all sizes. DataFacts is one of the few background screeners that holds the stringent National Association of Professional Background Screeners accreditation. They're certified by the WBENC as a 100% woman-owned business, and in 2018, they were ranked by HRO Today's Baker's Dozen customer satisfaction ratings as one of the top background screeners in the nation. You are in good hands with DataFacts. Visit datafacts.com to learn more and make sure to mention the Changemakers podcast. And now back to the show.
What advice would you give for individuals, for companies, in terms of them being involved in the community and taking those steps to authentically connect with the community?
You know, I think it's, you know, we have conversations about what we as a company want to support. And everybody has a play. Everybody gets to talk about it. Everybody gets to, as a matter of fact, when we did the scholarship, you know, people are like, oh, it's easy. You know, you pick who you want to pick. It really wasn't that way. Everybody here in our organization had had say in it. They looked at the information. They dug through all that. They found their heart. And at the end of the day, our hearts were all matched for Thistle and Bee for this year, right? We'll do it again next year, and I'm sure we'll have another one. But I would tell companies to allow, I'm not saying you have to drive it, because you don't want to force anybody to do that. Like, nobody needs to be forced into volunteering for anything or helping to support anything. But the companies, any company can easily implement a program where, you know, if you want to support something, we will help you support it. We may do some kind of a financial support. We will help you talk to the people you need to get involved. If you want to serve on a board, we'll help you serve on a board. If you want to go and be a volunteer, we'll help you volunteer. But that puts a lot of action mechanism on the owner of that company. Because if the owner of the company is involved and knows people, then he can help his people find something to plug into that they're passionate about. And I think it's important for every company in this city to do that.
I agree 100%. We're going to switch over. It's kind of a lightning round. So this is where it's a kind of a quick question, quick answer on your end, but fun chance just to have some fun.
All right, let's do it.
What's a recent book you've read?
Stop doing that.
Nice.
But I will say that that book is fabulous. It is powerful, and any, I have had a lot of people read it, and they realize that they are their own worst enemy. It's a good read.
Nice. All right. What's a recent either TV show, movie, sports? What's something you've recently watched?
You know, it's funny on TV. I don't dig into a lot of TV, really that much, except that it's on all the time. And so my wife is always watching, like, you know, crime, like How to Kill Your Husband shows. That's basically what every time I come home, it's like, what are you watching? It's like another Dateline, like How to Kill Your Husband. Right. She's planning. But anyway, the Dateline, or, you know, I mean, that seems to be what's on, or Snapped, or, you know, I'm not much of a choice. But so I haven't really, you know, seen something on TV that I could say I like watching that, or a movie lately.
That's funny. What do you like to do to relax?
Oh, man, that's a lot of things. So one of my favorite things to do to relax is literally just to chill out with the little guys. We build Legos. Legos is one of those things that's kind of my pastime. If I've got a big giant Lego, they love getting the Legos. They love for daddy to build the Legos. And, but that's a release for me. Like having to figure out and put the bricks together and build these structures. That's a really cool pastime for me. And it's kind of a meditation.
Connect you and my brother. That's what his is as well.
So. I love him, and the boys love him. We just kind of hang out and chill out and have some, what they call it, daddy time. They love having daddy time.
So where do you all like to go as a family vacation? And then what about just you and your wife?
So family vacation, we go every year for two weeks. We go down to Florida. It's just kind of, I grew up with the same thing. My dad always took 2 weeks, took the whole family down. We stayed at a place called Silver Dunes down in Destin. And so we've been staying on 30A. I think this year we're going to Perdido. But we'll take 2 weeks and we'll go. And that's the family vacation. Like, that's what we do. We don't do anything else. And then my wife and I, man, we have not, honestly, the boys are, what, 8 years old? So we have not been on a vacation in 8 years.
I can appreciate that.
Unbelievable, right? Am I the worst husband ever? But anyway.
Well, if you were to go on a vacation, where would you take her?
St. Lucia. That's where we got married.
Yeah.
And that's the last vacation that we took together. And so, of course, she's like, you know, our 10-year anniversary is coming up. You might want to pick up the pace on those tickets to St. Lucia, because this is when we're supposed to go back. I'm like, oh, this pressure, and you're watching How to Kill Your Husband shows, and I'm dying over here, man. You're killing me. So, but anyway, that's where we would go. It's a cool place. That's a cool place.
What about things that you enjoy doing here in the Mid-South? For all the listeners who are around the world who want to come to Memphis in the Mid-South, what are some things that you enjoy doing?
Man, I like to eat. I'm not gonna lie. I really like to eat. You know, obviously barbecue. Everybody likes barbecue, but yeah, I love to eat. And then I like I can't even do this coming to Memphis, but I like to, we like to ride bikes. So, and Memphis is so good for that. Like this is a little bit newer for us. You know, we got bikes for everybody for Christmas and my wife and I got bikes. I've not had a bike. She's not had a bike. So we got bikes. Now we're riding the Green Line or yeah. We're riding on the trails and we kind of have bikes that'll do both. And man, that is so cool because you can hop on that. You can hop on the Green Line and you can go down and you can stop and eat some pizza or hang out, you know, along the way. And there's just places to stop and enjoy the day and things like that. And that is just, there's just so many different places to go and it's fun. So we try to do that every weekend. We load all the bikes up and drag them over to Shelby Farms or down here. And we hop on one trail or the other and we spend, you know, a couple hours, 3 hours just riding bikes and having fun, having a great time. Love going to the games, love going to the Grizzlies games. That's a lot of fun. Everybody says, you know, you figure out, you know, they play and are they playing well? I don't really care if they're playing well or not. I like the experience of going to the game. And then, I haven't been to the soccer yet. That's something I want to experience, right? And Redbirds, of course, we grew up going to the Chicks. God, it was like back in the 70s, right? So Dad was a huge Redbirds fan. And so watching that's a lot of fun. Going to those is fun. Haven't done a lot of that, but I've done a lot of that in the past. And that's just a cool thing to do.
So what's a favorite quote? It doesn't have to be from your parents or anything, but just in general, a quote that motivates you or some sort of a phrase or thing that's always kind of stuck in your head.
So one of the quotes that motivates me probably the most is that life begins at the end of your comfort zone. And that is such a powerful. The other one that I really like is kind of funny is knowledge is knowing a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad. Big difference between the two.
I like that one.
Yeah,
that's good.
It's good.
That's why I love like memes and things like that. It's like some of these things are so like they're thought provoking, but they're hilarious.
Yeah, where do they come from?
Yeah,
right?
Like, who thought of that? That's awesome.
I gotta put that one out today. That's a good one. Launch it.
What? So last question, but on a serious note is. What, you know, you're creating your legacy obviously every single day, but what do you hope many, many, many years from now people say about you and your impact, especially on other people and, you know, here in the Mid-South?
Tough question. Legacy's an interesting one. And I don't, you know, I think about like long time from now, what really transpires? What do I leave, right? What do I leave behind? And I don't know. If it's a statue, I don't know, a statue or whatever. But I think in reality, my number one thing is that, because I know this from experience, if I can help an individual get more out of themselves than they're currently getting out of themselves, and that helps them to carve a path to a greater place, whatever that means, success in their mentality, in their family, in their business, it doesn't matter, whatever that looks like, then I think that is the legacy that spreads to others. And I don't know that there's a certain amount or a number of people that I would like to have an impact like that on. I know that one makes a change. If you're impacting one, you're making a huge change. Your legacy is there. But I think I'd like to be remembered by people as somebody that helped them grow to a place they'd never been before. And we did it through humor and we did it through love and we did it through vulnerability and we did it through humility.
Nice. So where can all these listeners go to learn more, to follow you online? Where would you direct us?
So they can go to the website, which is csp.sandler.com. We're on LinkedIn. I think it's CSP Sandler. And then, of course, I'm on LinkedIn. You can always look me up, Andrew Gieselman. We've got, you know, Facebook accounts and things like that. If you put in Sandler Mid-South, pretty much anywhere we're going to pop up.
Yeah.
And then of course, if they want to, you know, we can throw you on the video list and and keep people on that. A lot of people want to get those videos. Mm-hmm. We have videos that go out weekly. You know, we do the one for you guys, yep, which next week's is crazy awesome.
Nice.
Oh, my gosh, it's fun. So we love doing that, and people like getting them because it gives them a tidbit.
Because that's like a newsletter, so they can subscribe
to the tips.
Newsletter.
They can subscribe to it. We're going to have, you know, tips that go out. We'll have video thoughts of the week and things like that that are always kind of feeding, you know, the community or whatever. So, they can plug in there.
Well, Andrew Gieselman, you are a change maker. We greatly appreciate everything you do, not only for the Mid-South, but like we said, on the business side, the philanthropic side, you're so heavily your heart is geared around service to others, and you're making a huge difference. So we appreciate all you do and appreciate you being on the Changemakers podcast.
Thanks, Jeremy. Glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to the Changemakers podcast, produced by City Current and brought to you by Lipscomb Pitts Insurance and DataFax. To learn more about our guests and to share your stories of others leading by example, visit us online at citycurrent.com and follow us on social media using @citycurrent. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. Now, think big, start small, and act now. Be a change maker.